My soul had needed that struggle. It had needed to fight off my parents' idea of who I should be. It had needed to do this to become strong. It had needed to do this so that it could struggle up to the surface of the world and form itself in this struggle. It was, in fact, my parents' job to provide me with an impediment, to give my soul something to show its mettle against, something to prove itself against, something to express itself by overcoming. The soul is pushed down, and then the soul rises up again. The salmon leaps. This is precisely the struggle Kol Nidre depicts. There is another cry of the soul later on in the liturgy of the Kol Nidre service. Hear our voice. Don't cast us out when we are growing old. When our strength begins to fail us, don't abandon us. And there is a similarly desperate cry in the 27th Psalm, which we recite twice every day during the season of Teshuvah. Even though my father and mother abandon me, you will be with me. And these, I now realize, are also songs that are sung to the soul. The soul is with us even when our father and mother don't see us or recognize us. And the soul is with us when our father and mother die, and there is no one left to stand between us and death. Now that my father is dead, when I go to the cemetery in New Jersey to visit him, we can finally meet soul to soul without any of the interference that used to characterize our relationship when he was still here. This is invariably a dazzling, radiant, affirming encounter, in the course of which my father is able to give me all the things he always wanted to give me, but never could when he was alive. And I am able to receive all the things I always wanted from him, but could never get. Now my mother, having spawned us and lost her mate, has given up her life force. 12 years into Alzheimer's, she can neither speak nor recognize her own children. She cannot walk or bathe or feed herself. She can only sit blankly by her living room window, humming along to tapes of old show tunes from the 50s, giggling at the chipmunks and bluebirds who pass by the window. And my children now have risen up in the world. What kind of lives will they have? What kind of world will they live in? I worry about these things, and meanwhile I have already begun to fall away myself, although I still rage on, making long speeches and writing, furiously writing. The song my soul recognizes, the song that gets my soul's attention, is a song of loss. At least those are the first notes of this song. They come upon me suddenly, unexpectedly. I've barely had a chance to take my place. I've barely had a chance to settle into my own life. And yet there they are, those tragic notes pulling my soul from its scabbard. And because my soul responds to this call, because my soul allows itself to hear it, because my soul recognizes its first name in these notes and does not shrink away nor withhold itself from them, when the next notes come, the ones that rise, I rise with them in my full strength. This song is a deep song, a song of great truth, a song of great strength, and I draw strength from it as I rise. Thank God for this one run up the river, this blessed silvery sliver of a moment in which we may express our divine gift, or we may not. Our soul is called to this world by a cry of pain, and then it rises, and that very pain, met squarely and drunk in deeply, can become its strength and finally its triumph. Kol Nidre is about speaking true, about the power of speech. It is a gift to us from a time far back in our tribal consciousness when we seemed to understand these things better than we do now, when we seemed to understand the biblical warning that we are absolutely accountable for everything that comes out of our mouths. In fact, our ancestors took this so seriously that they instituted the Kol Nidre service to deal with it. They realized that it was a very serious thing to make a vow and not carry through with it. So here, at the holiest moment of the year, Here, at the moment when the purity of our soul is a matter of life and death, they instituted a ritual for the annulment of vows, so that we wouldn't have to bear the guilt of abusing the power of speech. The prominence of place given to speech in the Rambam's Law of Teshuvah is striking. These are the first words of this code. When we commit a sin, whether intentional or unintentional, and then we make repentance, we are obliged to make confession, vidui, before God. And this confession must be in words. Even in the days of the Great Temple, when we brought sacrifices for our sins, either intentional or unintentional, the sacrifice did not atone for these sins unless we did teshuvah, unless we made a verbal confession of them. Later, he writes, "And what is teshuvah? We abandon our sin and remove it from our thoughts and resolve in our hearts that we won't do it anymore. We repent of the past and proclaim before the knower of all purposes that we won't return to this kind of behavior again. And we need to make this confession with our lips moving, to say these things out loud that we have resolved in our heart." But the Rambam makes clear that these must not be empty words. If we make verbal confession without sincerely resolving to change in our hearts, he insists, we are like someone who goes into the mikvah, the purifying bath, with a sheretz, an impure insect, in his hand. We can't be purified while we are holding on to impurity, and we can't make teshuvah while our heart holds on to our misdeeds either. And not only does this confession have to be heartfelt, but according to the Rambam, it must be specific, and it is praiseworthy to make confession in public as well. So, clearly, verbal confession is basic to the process of teshuvah. In the last chapter, we looked at the verse from Parshat Netzavim that describes the process of teshuvah so precisely. The commandment to do teshuvah is not distant from you, the Torah insists. The word is very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, so you can do it. And in the chapter on Elul, I noted how the contents of the heart defy direct examination, but will often reveal themselves unbidden when we are trying to focus on something else. So, I suggested, a good way to catch a glimpse of precisely what is in our hearts is to watch, to become mindful of what keeps carrying our attention away as we try to focus on the words of the High Holiday Prayer Book. Or we might focus on our breath or our body instead, and watch what comes up then. Every spiritual tradition I am aware of speaks of a kind of layered mindfulness, a sensibility that works up and out of the body, to the heart, and then to the mind, and then finally to the soul. The Buddhist Sutra on Mindfulness describes this kind of layered grid of awareness, and the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition, speaks of it too. According to the Kabbalah, we start out with our awareness in Asiyah, the world of physicality, the world of the body, our most immediately accessible reality. Then we become aware of the heart, Yetzirah, the world of formation or emotion, that shadowy world between conception and its realization in material form. From there, we move on to the world of pure intellect, Briyah, or creation, and then to Atzilut, the realm of pure spiritual emanation. But it's that first step which concerns us the most at this time of year, moving from the body to the heart, focusing on the reality of our present circumstances and letting the contents of our heart come welling up in the process. So the first order of business in this process of teshuvah is becoming aware of the heart, either by direction or indirection. But this is only half the equation. We must also speak of what we find there. By bringing our awareness out of our hearts and into speech, by moving this consciousness outward to the light of the great world outside, we complete the process. Every year, just before Yom Kippur, I make a concerted effort to speak out the shadowy contents of my heart to another human being. I usually find myself speaking of things I have thought of 1,000 times before, of my anger, of my obstinacy, of my refusal to give up the grudges I hold against people. I know these things as well as I know the back of my own hand. I have thought these thoughts 1,000 times before. Still, to get them out makes a tremendous difference. I know them, but as long as they are unspoken, I can ignore them. I don't have to act on them. Now that I have said them out loud to another human being, they are out there in the world. It would be much harder to ignore them anymore, harder to deny them, harder to act in a way that failed to take them into account. This, I believe, is the basis of psychotherapy. We speak our unconscious dysfunctions, and in so doing, we disarm them. We call them out. We bring them up to the light of day, where, like the ancient river demons of the Near East, they lose their power. On a certain level, of course, we always know what we are doing. But as long as it remains unspoken, we can pretend to ignore it. The veil of unconsciousness is very thin, however, and as soon as we begin to speak, we pierce it, and we can't ignore what we were doing any longer. Speech is one of our distinctive human attributes. It is through speech that we make the inner outer, that we bring the metaphysical into the physical, that we make real the purely intellectual. It is through speech that action begins. Every time I speak, it is the result of something metaphysical arising in my soul as an idea or a spiritual impulse. It becomes speech in my mouth and then goes out onto the air of the room as a wave, a part of the world of Asiya, the physical world. Then it enters someone else's ear, and then their mind, where it is transformed into something metaphysical again. All this is a truly miraculous transaction and a decisively human power, and think of how intimately it joins us to those to whom we are speaking. Think of the intimate access it gives us to their inner lives, and vice versa. And speech is intimately joined to the power of gesture as well. Jean Piaget, the great child psychologist, based all his theories about child development on acute first-hand observation. He never obtained any advanced degrees. Rather, he got down on the floor and watched children with a focused, unwavering eye. Down on the floor, he watched closely as a young girl developed the ability to speak. He noticed that before she began to speak, she communicated by gesture. When she wanted to communicate the idea of no, she shook her head and waved a closed fist across her chest. When she first began to speak, the gesture was still quite pronounced. She said no, and she shook her head, and she waved her fist across her body. As her speaking became more refined, the gesture began to get smaller and smaller, and finally it almost disappeared altogether. Almost, but never completely. There was always at least a vestige of this gesture in her speech, an almost imperceptible waver of the head, a twitching of the hand. Piaget saw this pattern replicated in hundreds of children. For all of them, there was some sort of gesture before speech, and a gesture that remained afterward also. That's why we feel speech so intensely. It always retains the force of this primal gesture. And that is how speech is connected to the primary pre-lingual world, a world of great power. How did God create the world? Through speech. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God said, "Let there be dry land on the waters," and there was dry land. The one exception was us. We were created by breath. God created us by breathing air into our nostrils, and according to Rebbe Nachman, this means that we are directly connected to God through our breath. Our breath connects us to the level of experience that is deeper than speech, deeper than the forms speech creates. Not the word for the thing, but the thing itself. Breath has primacy over speech. We can breathe without speaking, but we can't speak without breathing. The kind of speech the Rambam refers to is speech that arises from the breath, speech that expresses this primary sense of reality. When our speech expresses this deeper sense of things, we are on our way to teshuvah. We are on our way to bringing that which is in our hearts out into the world. Speech that is not so connected is to no avail, at least not where teshuvah is concerned. It is like a person in the ritual bath holding on to an impure insect. 10 years ago, the state of California reinstituted the death penalty. 10 executions have been carried out at San Quentin Prison just outside of San Francisco since then, and I have attended each of these in protest. Many others have come to protest these executions also, and we have gotten to know each other. One of them is a remarkable woman named Abigail. 18 years ago, Catherine Blunt, Abigail's youngest daughter, was living with a friend, a young man named Eric, sharing an old farmhouse outside Auburn, California, in the hills above Sacramento. Eric had a best friend named Douglas. They were both Vietnam vets, and both had gotten heavily involved in drugs while in Vietnam. Back in the States, Eric managed to clean himself up. Douglas never could. Now, he was pretty seriously strung out and prone to psychotic paranoid delusions. Finally, he came to believe that his friend Eric had stolen his power as a human being, and that the only way he could survive was to kill Eric. So Douglas went up to Auburn and murdered his friend Eric, and he killed Catherine Blunt, too, simply because she happened to be in the house when he got there. It was a horrible crime, a grisly, senseless double murder, and there was absolutely no question as to Douglas's guilt. For 8 years afterward, Abigail was consumed with anger and rage. She screamed in the shower every day. She cried every time she was alone. She couldn't even drive a car, because as soon as she was alone behind the wheel, she would start to cry so hard she couldn't see the road. The sheriff's department told her that they were going to find the culprit, convict him, and execute him. Then, they assured her, she would have peace. She believed them. She felt she had to hurt someone for what he had done to her daughter, and she thought that once she did, she would feel better. This went on for 8 years. Douglas was arrested, and then he was convicted, but there was no peace for Abigail in this, and she began to realize for a certainty that there would be no peace when he was executed either. Finally, something turned in her, and she realized she would never find any peace until she could forgive Douglas. It took her 4 more years to be able to do it. She took small steps at first. She signed up for a meditation class. She started reading books. Then it became a full-time obsession. For 4 years, she never read a novel or a magazine. She never watched TV or went to the movies. She studied voraciously. She studied Buddhism, Hinduism, and the Jewish teachings on forgiveness. She soaked everything up like a sponge, but still her heart was full of pain, rage, and violence. She thought that she had actually forgiven Douglas at one point, but she still felt no peace. One of her friends told her her forgiveness would never be real unless she verbalized it to Douglas. But that only made Abigail furious. She even stopped speaking to this friend for a while. "What do you mean, tell him? I don't have to tell him. I know what's going on in my own heart." But shortly after that, 4 years after she felt that mysterious turning in her breast, and 12 years after her daughter's murder, Abigail heard a voice, an inner voice, but a voice as loud and as clear as any she had ever heard in her life. It said, "You must forgive him, and you must tell him you forgive him. You must speak to him." Abigail complied. She sat down immediately and wrote Douglas the following note. "Dear Douglas, the Spirit of God in me sends a blessing to the Spirit of God in you." Then she put the letter in the mailbox, and as soon as she did, she felt healed. She felt herself to be in a state of grace, and she has felt that way ever since. Now, all this happened unconsciously and unintentionally on the level of instinct. True, 4 years before, she had embarked on the path of forgiveness, but she had never said to herself, "I am full of pain. This anger is destroying me." She had simply heard the voice, written her words, sent them out, then immediately felt how much these things had been true, how full of pain she had been for those 12 years since her daughter had been murdered, how much her anger had been destroying her inside. She felt this all quite clearly in the way she felt the moment before and the way she felt the moment after she wrote to Douglas. She felt the physiological damage that violence and anger and rage had done to her. She felt what it had done to her body, her mind, her soul, her family. And she felt the heroic effort her soul had made to let all of this go, and she knew for a certainty that she had been healed, that she had been able to bring all this up and then let it out the moment she had gotten the words out, the moment she had put the words to paper and then sent them away, the moment she had spoken true. The Kol Nidre is also a voice, an ancient voice, but one that still calls to us. We can hear its message in this poem by Paul Celan. Speak, you too. Speak as the last. Say out your say. Speak, but don't split off no from yes. Give your say this meaning too. Give it the shadow. Give it shadow enough. Give it as much as you know is spread round you from midnight to midday and midnight. Look around. See how things all come alive. By death. Alive. Speaks true who speaks shadow. The path of transformation is long, and it is arduous. We spend weeks and months peering into our hearts, feeling the heft of our shadow and the hurt in our soul. Then Kol Nidre comes, and it is finally time to speak of those thoughts and feelings that haunt us. Somewhere in the 24 hours of Yom Kippur, we must speak the shadow. We must speak it in private, and we must speak it in public. We must speak it to a friend, or speak it to a stranger. We must speak it to a husband or a wife. We must speak it in the shadow language of our own heart, or speak it through the liturgy, the communal unburdening of the vidui, the confessional prayer we recite over and over again during these 24 hours. The Kol Nidre is calling us. It is saying, speak, speak the shadow, as much as you know is spread around you midnight to midday to midnight. Speak and let go. Speak and be human. Speak and be healed. Every year, around 10 weeks before Kol Nidre, we read a strange foreshadowing of this night in the Torah, in Parshat Matot. Parshat Matot begins with a discussion of vows in which we hear the precise language of Kol Nidre. When a man makes a vow to God or swears an oath which is binding on his soul, all vows and all bonds on his soul shall stand. Kol Nidre, Visare, Asher Asarah, Al Nafsha Yakum. I always get a chill of fear in my spine when we read this. It's the first distant echo of the high holidays, of Kol Nidre. What will I do this year? What will I say to the congregation? The irony is that the subject of both Parshat Matot and Kol Nidre is the relationship between what we say and what we do. Both the Torah and the rabbis of the Talmud believed in the primacy of language, in the mysterious power of language to create a reality. In the account of creation we read every year in the book of Genesis, God literally speaks the world into existence. And the Talmud affirms the creative potential of speech. Did you know that abracadabra is a Jewish word? The Aramaic words avra kadabra mean it came to pass as it was spoken, a popular Talmudic dictum that expressed the widely held Talmudic belief that things do indeed come to pass because they are spoken, that speech has the power to cause the world to come into being. On Kol Nidre, we affirm that it is an absolute catastrophe. It throws the soul out of balance to have our words out of line with our deeds. But it is also an inevitable catastrophe. So every year at the beginning of this great ritual day in which we purify our souls, we remedy this. We forgive ourselves in advance for all the times in the coming year when we will make vows we will be unable to keep, when our words will be out of line with our deeds, and we acknowledge in this ritual that these times will certainly and inevitably come. Parshat Matot deals with one very particular instance of this, the case in which a woman makes a vow she can't keep because she is living under the power of a man, either her husband or her father, who won't let her keep it. The Torah's remedy in such a case is to forgive the woman for not keeping her vow. This is an interesting passage for a number of reasons. For one thing, it is a very good example of how the authors of the Torah, divine and or human, mediated its values with the realities of human life. The Torah has a very strong sense of what is, and an equally strong sense of what ought to be, and it recognizes very clearly that if the second ever gets too far away from the first, the Torah will become a repository of irrelevant and impossible ideals. So it is that the Torah will often leave an institution standing, even one it abhors, and simply try to infuse that institution with its values rather than do away with it altogether. If it does the latter, it will place itself at too great a distance from the society it is trying to transform. The Torah clearly has the idea that every human being needs to have absolute freedom of choice. Otherwise, the religious system the Torah introduces couldn't possibly work. It recognizes that in a social system where women lived under the power of men, they didn't have this kind of freedom, but it sensed the futility of trying to overthrow this system overnight. So it simply expressed its values and left the system intact, trusting that in another 2,000 or 3,000 years the value would work its magic on the system, and the system would give way. Avra kadabra. This, of course, is precisely what has happened. The attitude the Torah expresses toward women may not be consistent with contemporary values of gender equality, but the fact of the matter is, it is the beginning of these contemporary values, of the vectorial movement that resulted in them. The women of the Torah were oppressed, but by subtly indicating its unhappiness with their oppression, the Torah began to undo it. But all this operates on another level as well. This I learned from the commentaries of Ibn Jikatilia, the great medieval Spanish Kabbalist. Jikatilia saw this whole business as a remez, a mystical hint at the secret workings of the psyche. The woman in question here, according to Jikatilia, was not an actual person, but rather the neshama, the soul, the feminine representation of the will of God, the tzelem Elohim, the image of God that resides deep in every human soul. The man whose power it lives under is the yetzer hara, the evil impulse which often prevents the neshama from making its will manifest. This is really quite a useful metaphor from several points of view. First, it tells us that action really does spring from a kind of inner speech, the language we use to define the world to ourselves. Like God, each of us participates in the creation of the world. Blessed be he who speaks and the world comes into being, we say of God in our liturgy every morning. But it applies to us as well. We also speak and bring the world into being. This world presents us with a great chaos of information. Our speech encourages us to select certain possibilities out of this chaos and to discard others. Not only that, but this deep inner speech that precedes action is always well-intentioned, always comes from the neshama, that deep inner echo of the Word of God. But this deep inner voice often fails to make it to the surface of the world in the form of action because of the tumultuous whirlwind of impulses it encounters between the heart and the world. This, in fact, is what Jikatilia identifies as the yetzer hara, that complex of impulses and dysfunctions that so often prevents us from doing what we know we should do. As accurate as this picture of the soul of our inner life might be, what is really impressive about Jikatilia's teaching is the prescription he suggests. What do we do when this man, this yetzer hara, prevents this woman living under his power, the neshama, from manifesting her vow, from manifesting the divine speech at the base of all human action? We do the same thing that the Torah suggests we do in the human case. We recognize that there was nothing the woman could do about it. Or in other words, that there is really nothing we can do about it when our complex of impulses and dysfunctions prevents us from doing what we know we should do. There is no blame in this, Jikatilia insists. It is like a vow that cannot be fulfilled because we are living under someone else's power. But actually, Jigatilya suggests, there is something we can do about it. We can strengthen the woman, the neshama, so that she can express her full strength. How do we do this? By doing spiritual work, by practicing spiritual discipline, by meditating, by performing religious rituals, performing tzedakah and gemilut chasadim, charity and acts of loving kindness. When we do these things, we strengthen the neshama, we let her have her way, and sooner or later she finds herself able to overcome the yetzer hara and make her will manifest in the world. So it is that the historical reality the text recognizes is mirrored very precisely in the realm of the soul. It is mirrored in our lives as well. My dear friend and partner at the Makor Or Meditation Center, Norman Fisher, was counseling a man a few years ago. This man had been walking around with a grudge, with hatred in his heart that he just couldn't get rid of. He had recently moved to a new town in the East Bay, and one day a neighbor told a racist joke in his presence, and he didn't laugh. Instead, he gently told this man that he didn't like racist jokes and asked him please not to say anything like that in his presence in the future. But just to show that there was nothing personal in this, some time later, he invited this man and his wife to have dinner with him and his wife at their home. The neighbor and his wife came, and they all sat down to a lovely dinner, whereupon this fellow proceeded to unleash a bitter torrent of abuse on his unsuspecting host. "I don't like you, and no one else around here likes you either. You just don't get it, and you never will," he said. They all managed to limp through the rest of the evening somehow, but ever since then, this student of Norman's had been walking around with a great bitterness toward his neighbor, a simmering anger constantly eating away at him. So now, he was coming to Norman for advice on how he might get rid of these feelings. I don't know if Norman viewed his student's story as skeptically as I did. I don't know if he wondered, as I did, if there wasn't some hostility in his having the neighbor to his house for dinner in the first place, if he hadn't done it so that he could feel superior to him. Maybe the neighbor sensed this, and that's why he was so hostile at the dinner table. Maybe Norman's student felt bitter toward this man before he was insulted over his own dinner table. Maybe that's why he was having such a hard time overcoming this bitterness. What I do know is that Norman promptly advised his student to stop trying to get rid of these feelings. After all, they were his feelings. They were his reality, and there are no alternative realities. This is what was welling up from the inner recesses of his soul, from the neshama. Why not let her have her way? Instead of trying to get rid of these feelings, Norman suggested, why not forgive himself for having them? And having so forgiven himself, why not try to inhabit these feelings as deeply as he could? Why not unleash them and give them free rein? Maybe then, Norman said, he might find himself following these feelings all the way to the core of his being and to the deep well of suffering there. This, after all, was not just his suffering, not just his anger and pain, but the bottomless and endless suffering that lay at the core of all human experience, the same suffering that had led the neighbor to tell the racist joke and then to insult him at his own dinner table in front of his wife. Finally, this sense of suffering might give way to a deep and abiding compassion. The compassion that usually comes when we realize that we and our fellow human beings are all fellow sufferers. If Ibn Jigatilya had heard Norman give this advice, first of all, I'm quite sure he would have agreed, and second, I think he would have understood it this way. He would have understood Norman to be advising his student to forgive himself for his anger and the grudge he bore the other man. The student may very well have vowed to himself not to live by anger, not to bear grudges, but he was under the power of impulses that made it impossible for him to fulfill this vow. So what he needed to do was to strengthen his neshama, and the way to do this was to let her have her way, to inhabit her as completely as he could. If he did this, perhaps it would lead him to the word of God at her root, to the suffering that unites us all, and to the abiding compassion that always seems to come on the heels of the recognition of this suffering. Spiritual discipline can help us make this transformation. Meditation is a time when we inhabit ourselves this way. Shabbat is too, so is daily prayer or any kind of daily spiritual discipline. Work, TV, and our usual frantic rush of activities are all devices we use to distract ourselves from ourselves, to keep from looking at who we are, to keep from fully inhabiting ourselves. Most of us are afraid to inhabit ourselves, afraid of what we might find at the core of our being. This is how we are caught unprepared. According to Jigatilya, this fear is the Yetzer Hara, the man under whose power we live, the one who prevents us from fulfilling the deepest vows of the soul. Shabbat and meditation give the neshama free rein. They strengthen the neshama so that she can overcome this fear. They strengthen the neshama until we can finally hear her voice. We hear this voice in the Kol Nidre. We hear the inner logarithm by which we define ourselves. Hearing this, we can forgive ourselves. Hearing this, there is nothing to be afraid of anymore. Hearing this, we are prepared to speak this world into being. Avrakadabra. Who are the Avaryonim? Addressing this question earlier, we mentioned the possibility that the Avaryonim are the sinners, the imperfect among us. The word Avar, after all, means to sin or to transgress. Someone might say, we can't pray with the imperfect. This is a very important time, and only those who are morally unblemished should pray now. All those others, all those imperfect ones, will prevent our prayers from being answered. But the Beit Din, the rabbinical court, comes to say, there is no such thing as a morally unblemished human being. There are only Avaryonim, only the imperfect and the incomplete. So not only are we permitted to pray with them, we are required to. Pray we must, and there is simply no one else to pray with. And besides, it is precisely because we are Avaryonim that we need each other so. Since each of us is imperfect by nature, since each of us is incomplete, it is only in community that we begin to find a sense of wholeness, a sense of completion. So not only is it permissible, not only is it required for us to pray with the Avaryonim, the imperfect ones, we have a desperate need to do so. In praying with them, we begin to find the answer to our own imperfection. None of us is whole by ourselves. A spiritual community is one in which we find wholeness, completion with others. What we lack is provided by somebody else. Now, I know this is a positively un-American idea. The John Wayne in us balks at it furiously. We are indoctrinated by our culture to see ourselves as self-sufficient. One of the hardest things I have to do as a rabbi is to convince people who are ill or in trouble to accept help from others. In this culture, needing help from others is seen as a sign of weakness, as something to be ashamed of. But I think that deep down we all know, we all understand intuitively, that none of us is whole by ourselves. And this understanding is the basis of spiritual community. We all seem to know in the deepest part of ourselves that we need to be part of something larger than ourselves to be complete. A couple of months ago, I was driving on the central freeway in heavy traffic when all of a sudden a small red car jammed full of teenagers came speeding up an entrance ramp, crossed three lanes of traffic without even slowing down, and forced an old Volkswagen Bug off the road and onto the median strip at the center of the freeway. I watched this happen in horror, but it only got worse. With the Volkswagen still up on the median strip, the red car sped away as fast as it could, the kids in the back seat laughing hysterically as it did. I was incensed. I took off after the red car at high speed until I got close enough to write down its license plate number. Then I slowed down and waited for the Volkswagen to catch up to me. It came by a few minutes later. The woman driving it was weaving all over, as if in a daze. I followed her till she got off the freeway at Fell Street, flagged her down, told her I had seen the whole thing, gave her the license number and my card, and told her to call me if she needed a witness. A few weeks later, the following letter arrived in the mail. 3 years ago, I was assaulted and sustained severe injuries. I'm still suffering the consequences of that attack. So when I was assaulted by that vehicle on August 5th, it felt like the same thing was happening all over again. The difference was that last time nobody saw, and this time you saw the whole thing and took the time and energy to follow me off the freeway. Your involvement was psychologically healing for me. Thank you for making a connection with me and giving credence and integrity to the event. I am very grateful. I don't tell you this story to brag about what a great guy I am, at least not only for that reason. The truth is, my following that car that day probably had more to do with a generalized rage against teenagers on my part than with my virtue. But I think this story makes a profound and important point. We are all avaryonim, incomplete in ourselves. It takes the presence of other people to make us whole, to give credence and integrity to our experience. According to Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, even God had that need. Even God needed a witness to lend integrity and credence to the creation, and that, apparently, is why God created us. So if God has this need, how can we be ashamed of it? How can we see ourselves as being above it? Let me tell you about the best day I've had in a long time. As I describe it, you are going to think I am crazy, and no doubt I am. This may not seem like a very good day to you at all, especially at first. The day began with a prayer minyan, as many of my days do. The service was particularly beautiful and strong that morning, and I felt my ego dissolving into the prayers even more than I usually do. I spent the rest of the morning doing pastoral visits. First, I went out to Marin County to see a woman who had been sick for a long time and was now terribly depressed. She was angry at her illness, taking it out on her family, terribly down, refusing to move out of bed, and insisting that people leave her alone and let her sleep all the time. She was furious at her husband for trying to get her out of bed, and now especially furious with him because he had arranged my visit. Nevertheless, it was remarkable how she roused herself for my visit, how the appearance of someone from the outside lifted her energy and made her come out of herself in a way she hadn't been able to do by herself. I left her and went to the hospital to see one of our regulars who had had a difficult surgery just the week before and was not recovering well. She was seriously depleted, barely communicating, and terribly despondent. But I was able to tell her that everyone from the synagogue was thinking of her and that we were continuing to pray for her, and I could feel her spirit lifting when I said this. It was very real, a palpable feeling. There was another woman from Long Island at the same hospital. She had come to our synagogue the week before her surgery was scheduled and had asked me if I would visit her afterward. Her surgery had not gone so well, and she was also terribly discouraged, and now she needed blood, lots of it. I told the woman who runs the synagogue blood drive, and she managed to get 10 people from our synagogue, all with the right blood type, down to the hospital within hours. The woman and her family were overwhelmed. They had felt such a deep sense of need, and our community, their community in the larger sense, had answered it. Finally, I saw another person in despair, a woman who had suddenly fallen ill and who had lost faith in her capacity to get well again, even though medically there was every reason to expect she would recover. I sat by her bed and told her over and over again how much I loved her, how much everyone in the community loved her, and that we would never abandon her no matter what. Although her despair did not lift, I could see that she was beginning to draw strength from this reminder that our community was still there and still mindful of her. And I noticed something else, this time about myself. Although it was very difficult to see this woman so reduced by her illness, it felt wonderful nevertheless to be telling her that I loved her, that we all loved her, that we would never let her go. It gave me a great deal to be able to say these things to her. Still, at the middle of the day, as I went home to quickly change my clothes, what did I have? I had 4 people, one more ill than the next, and none of them quite able to summon the will to go on, none of them with the faith that their life was worth living, none of them quite believing in their lives or in life in general. Then I got in the car and drove up to Healdsburg as quickly as I could to do a wedding. The traffic was bad, and I was already a little late. I do a lot of weddings these days, and I love to do them. It is such a deep and intimate thing to share with people. Set against the deep discouragement about life, the deep despair I sense in our society, especially among young people, there is nothing so optimistic as a wedding, nothing which says, in spite of appearances, I believe life is good and the world will go on, so forcefully as this. Since I was so late, the wedding began almost as soon as I arrived. We signed the wedding contract, the ketuvah, very quickly, and then we went out to stand under the wedding canopy, the chuppah. The chuppah had been erected in the middle of one of the loveliest vineyards in Sonoma County. It was an incredibly beautiful day, bright sun, blue skies, but the wind was blowing very hard. The ketuvah was now resting on an easel next to the chuppah, and the wind blew it over several times, and it kept blowing my kippah, my skull cap, off my head, and it was positively tearing through the cloth top of the chuppah. I thought it was going to blow us away altogether, but it never did. We just kept picking up the ketuvah. I kept putting my kippah back on my head, and the chuppah miraculously held. The Hebrew word for wind is ruach. It also means spirit or soul, and the truth was, there was even more ruach, more spirit inside that chuppah than out. My feelings are always very intense under the chuppah, but this was something else again, something more powerful than I had ever felt before. And suddenly I understood what I was feeling. I was feeling that this beautiful young couple standing before me was manifesting the affirmation for life that the four sick people I had been with earlier in the day could not manifest. I felt that in some strange way they were manifesting it for them, that the resounding yes this couple was now saying to life had somehow come out of the four sick ladies I had seen earlier in the day. It was their missing piece. It was their voice in the wind. Something so deep it could only be said by all the people I had seen that day, by a whole community, and not by any particular person. That young couple in Healdsburg had no way of knowing, of course, but I was quite convinced that the reason the feeling under their chuppah was so strong, so deep, was because it included the despair of these four ladies, and in fact transformed that despair. And the four ladies had no idea. But this young couple saying yes to the world with the wind blowing furiously all around them was saying yes for them, saying what they needed to say but could not quite manage to say. So they were all avaryonim, the four sick women and the young couple getting married. And they were praying together, and taken together, their prayer spread a canopy of deep peace over the Sonoma Hills. The Kol Nidre is also such a prayer. It is a prayer that calls the soul back to itself, a prayer that calls the soul to its real home, and that home is always in something larger than itself. We are Avar Yonim. We are incomplete and imperfect and cannot survive without a spiritual community that can make us whole, that can give us what we need, what we don't have. And what we need most of all is to give. We need to give what we have and someone else does not. We are not John Wayne. We are the Avar Yonim. And that sense of wholeness, of completion that we have been chasing after all of our lives, but that always eludes us as individuals, is something so deep it can only be found in a whole community, in that shifting composite of need and lack and gift we create when we come together to acknowledge that we need each other. The Kol Nidre calls the soul to its community and to its rightful place in this great shifting sea of life. Chapter 9. Death and Yom Kippur Atone. One Sunday morning some years ago, I was rushing out the door to the airport on my way to a rabbinical conference when I received an emergency call from the Board of Rabbis hotline. A woman, quite distraught, was on the line. She had given birth to a baby boy that morning, but he had been born without most of his brain, and she'd been told he would die that afternoon. She wasn't married to the boy's father, he was a Catholic, and a priest had already been called in to perform a baptism. Now the mother and her parents, who were Jewish, wanted something Jewish done. They were at the University of California San Francisco Medical Center, so I stopped in on my way to the airport. The baby was in the intensive care nursery, a room I'd never been in before. It was like a hothouse. The temperature was kept at over 90 degrees. What did they want done? As the woman and her parents spoke, it seemed clear that it was important to them that the baby have a name. According to Jewish law, we don't name a baby until it has been alive for at least a week, but this seemed like a bad time to stand on halakha. They had already formed a strong bond with this child, and it was important to them that he have an identity, a Jewish identity. They also seemed to want some sort of last rites performed. And so it was that I ended up doing one of the strangest and saddest things I have ever had to do as a rabbi, saying the blessings for the beginning of life and the end of life in one breath, in a single prayer. First, I said the prayer for naming a child that is usually part of a Brit Milah, ritual circumcision. And then I said the final prayer a Jew says in life, the Vidui, the last confession. I said them as one long prayer. We named the child Baruch, a blessing. Everyone in the room, the woman, the baby's Catholic father, both sets of grandparents, everyone had the strange sense about this tragic and radiant child that he was perfect, that this was a brief but perfect life, not perfect in the sense of being the best, not in a comparative sense, but in the sense of being absolutely what it was. This was a perfect life, a life without a brain or any duration to speak of, a life begun and ended in a single breath. The rabbis had an expression, kefitzat haderech, a shortening of the way. It expressed a sense of telescoping a journey, the sense of crossing an impossible distance in a few brief strides, and being in the presence of a life that rushed so precipitously called to mind the terror of my own end. This life was a synopsis of all life. We are born and we die, and nothing that happens in between is nearly as important as these two fundamental facts of life. And there was something else I felt that day, which I have often felt before and after, but never quite so strongly as that morning in the intensive care nursery at UCSF. And that is that once life is over, it is clear that it has taken up no time or space at all. I often stand with people at the last moment of their life, and I always feel this. Whether they are 8 days old or 89 years, the moment life is gone, it is nowhere, neither in time nor in space. In the words of the psalmist, the days of a human being are like the grass. We flourish as a flower in the field, then a wind passes over, and we are gone. No one can even see the place where we were anymore. All the world is a narrow bridge, Rebbe Nachman said, a narrow bridge between the nothingness at the beginning and the nothingness at the end. We spend our whole lives on this precarious span, unaware that we are even on it. Then one day we wake up and see it, and we feel terror. We say to ourselves, my God, what have I been doing with my life? The high holidays are also a bridge, a compressed journey, kefitzat haderech, the voyage from birth to death in 10 days' time. Rosh Hashanah is all about birth, and Yom Kippur is about death. Rosh Hashanah is Yom Harat Ha'olam, the day the world is born, and Yom Kippur is the day we rehearse for our death by wearing a shroud and by abstaining from life-affirming activities like eating and sexuality. But perhaps the most profound connection between death and Yom Kippur is the mysterious claim the Talmud makes for both of them. Both Yom Kippur and death atone. We say the Vidui, the final confession, on two occasions in our lives, on Yom Kippur and on the day of our death. The word for atonement, Kippur, kaparah, means a covering over. Death is a covering over. Sometimes I feel this quite literally at the graveyard. I know that many people have a fear of being buried. But sometimes, when we are shoveling the dirt over a casket at the cemetery, I get the feeling that we are covering our loved one over with earth, as we would cover a baby with a blanket. The vast blankness of death covers over all our wrongdoing in this life, and the communal chanting of the vidui on Yom Kippur, this sea of shared acknowledgement, this commonality of wrongdoing, seems to cover over our individual sin as well. But most of us are singularly uncomforted by the prospect of being forgiven upon our death. While we are acting out this pageant of the journey from birth to death, there is Moses, in the Torah, in the background of our communal consciousness, dying quietly but clinging to life with everything he has. We often read Parshat Vayelech the week before Yom Kippur. This Torah portion begins with Moses once again pleading to be allowed to live and to enter the promised land. Between the lines of this text, the Midrash perceives a titanic struggle between Moses and God. God seals the decree against Moses and swears by the ineffable name that Moses will not enter the promised land. Moses then utters more than 1,500 prayers. He draws a circle around himself and stands at the center and proclaims, "I will not move from this spot until the judgment against me is suspended." God promptly orders every gate in heaven locked, lest Moses' prayers find an opening. The prayers are fruitless in the end, and when Moses sees this, he begs heaven and earth, the sun and the moon, the stars and the planets, the mountains and the rivers, and finally the sea itself to intercede for him, to no avail. Finally, God asks, "Why are you so aggrieved at your impending death?" And Moses answers, "I am afraid of the sword of the angel of death, of the pain of death itself." God replies, "If that's the reason, then don't worry. I won't deliver you to the angel of death." But Moses still clings desperately to life. A few hours before his death, God says to him, "How long will you endeavor in vain to avert your death? You have only 3 hours to live. Make better use of them." But Moses bargains on furiously. "Let me live on the wrong side of the Jordan," he begs. "Let me live someplace else altogether. Let me live on as a beast of the field or a bird in the sky." "Now you have only 1 hour," God says. "Now you have only a few minutes." We see the same fear of death and the same clinging to life at all costs among the rabbis of the Talmud. In Masachet Moed Katan, we read that when Rav Seorim, Rabbi Rabba's brother, was sitting by his bedside, he saw Rabba drifting in and out of death. Then Rabba sat up and said to him, "Please tell the angel of death not to torment me." Rav Seorim said, "Me tell him? I thought you were his intimate friend." Rabba replied, "Since my mazel, fortune, has been handed over to him, he takes no heed of me." Rav Seorim then asked, "After you die, show yourself to me in a dream." Rabba did this, and as soon as he appeared, Rav Seorim asked, "Did it hurt?" Rabba said, "No, it was like lifting a hair out of a bowl of milk. But were the Holy One to say to me, 'Go back to the world as you were,' I wouldn't do it." That's how great a burden the fear of death is. The rabbis were quite full of this fear, and they used all their wit and piety to try to outwit the angel of death. Rabbi Eliezer was eating trumah, the special food set aside for offerings which only the priests could eat, when the angel of death showed himself to him. "You can't take me while I'm performing such a great mitzvah," he told the angel of death, and so the fatal moment was averted. Rabbi Sheset also averted death for a few moments. He caught sight of the angel in the marketplace, and he said, "Will you seize me out in the open like a beast? Come to the house and do it." Rav Ashi also caught sight of the angel of death in the marketplace. He said, "Give me 30 days to review my studies, for isn't it written, 'Happy is he that comes here bringing his learning ready with him?'" The angel of death came again on the 30th day. "What's the hurry?" Ashi asked. Death replied, "Your successor, Huna ben Natan, is close on your heels." As for Hista, the angel of death could never overcome him, because he would never shut up. He was always repeating Torah out loud, so the angel settled on a cedar tree outside the house of study. The tree cracked. Rav Hista was distracted and stopped studying out loud for a moment, and the angel overcame him. As for Rabbi Hia, he was so busy that the angel of death couldn't get an appointment to see him. Apparently, we are not the first to believe that workaholism will save us from the angel of death.